Live from New York City, it's the Gary Mel Show. And now, your host, Gary Mel.
Gary Nall. Today, I'm going to give you some insights on some of the newest in anti-aging. Also, how a substance found in grapes prevents a mutant protein that leads to cancer. We also are going to have a guest, a very interesting guest, and one that I'm sure many people in this audience are familiar with, because she has done so much to fight on behalf of the average person. She's out there, Marjorie Cohen. And Marjorie is a, well, we're going to talk about, will Congress authorize indefinite detention of Americans who opposed the executive policies? We're not talking about illegal aliens. We're talking about you and I. And by the way, she is a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, a criminal defense lawyer, and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. So she specializes in international human rights and crimes such as torture and drone strikes and U.S. foreign policy. That will be an interesting discussion. From our environmental segment today, I'm going to talk about rising seas and the big wake-up call for people living in Florida, especially on the East Coast. And also from the international in Europe climate issue, a 3 degrees Celsius will double Europe's drought risk. And that's happening, in the process happening now. Also, every model, every single model ever done on global warming has got to be redone. The ones about Antarctica are wrong because they've discovered over 100 volcanoes, and some are active, which means that even though they're miles down, all that lava is flowing, and it's heating up Antarctica, which is causing a massive melting. We'll get to that. Then I have some short audio clips on a variety of topics, including Naomi Wolf, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He gets President Trump an interesting little message. And also, only I guess on Fox News, a guest talking about how Trump's child detention camps are so luxurious, black folk wish they lived there. Really? Oh, God. You don't make this stuff up. You'll hear it. And then you hear a response. And also, Trey Gowdy, a former prosecutor, went after Rosenstein at the Department of Justice to hurry up his investigation. And I believe all of us want to know what's the outcome. And if people are guilty, bring them to trial. If you have evidence, take it to a grand jury. So, as you see, we have a lot to share. We're going to start with the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and the State University of Rio. And this Brazilian study shows the action of resveratrol, resveratrol, on the inhibition of an amyloid aggregates of a mutant P53 protein and a mutation found in more than half malignant tumors. This is what we know as grapes preventing a agglomeration of a mutant protein. In lay language, they found that when you have grapes, the bottom line is it helps block this protein from creating cancer. That's the simple way of doing it, and it, in a major way. Once again, I have mentioned many times in the past that I consider grapes be one of nature's 10 most perfect superfoods: the skin, the seed, and the flesh. And that's why eating grapes, drinking grape juice, I mean, you can buy organic Concord grape juice in every health food store in America, and or grape concentrate. That's where they wick off about one-third to one-half of the water, so you're getting more potent nutrients going into your body. So all that's good. Take grapes, help prevent cancer. There is something here from the Technical University of Munich, and I read it a couple times just to be sure that it was saying the same thing that I've been aware of for a long time, and that is that these endocrine-disrupting chemicals, EDCs, these exogenous substances that we find in plastic containers, plastic water bottles, many of the things we cook with, microwave with, these are dangerous to our hormones, and like biphenyl A and phthalates. And we have these, and now they're shown to really adversely affect our DNA. So no longer can we say that, oh, it's not a big deal. Yeah, it is. The reports in this current issue of Scientific Reports, and it just means that because we're exposed to so many of these hormone-disrupting chemicals, and by the way, when you're eating a lot of non-organic fruits and vegetables, the sprays on them also contribute to our susceptibility to DNA alteration. So we really have to go wherever possible organic. Now, if you can't get organic, and there are times and places where you simply can't, then you can always wash the fruits and vegetables by putting some hydrogen peroxide in water, 50-50, and then agitating it, meaning you just take your hand and shake the fruits or vegetables, and then rinse it and do it again. And that way you'll remove about 98% of the surface spray. Now, there are some products where that won't change how much was absorbed through the root system. And that's why, whenever possible, get organic and not have these gene alterers in our body. Also, the gut microbes, the good bacteria in your body, they partner with a protein to regulate vitamin D. This is from Pennsylvania State University. And it's just, they do what's called cell signaling. And it helps better utilize vitamin D. And this is part of our microbiota, or the good bacteria in your gut. And let's go back to the basics. Put it together this simply. Eat good foods, healthy foods, clean foods, and you end up with good bacteria. Unhealthy foods, processed foods, dead in nature foods, toxic bacteria. And you get a very big outcome that is substantially different. Good bacteria always wins. Also, from the University of Eastern Finland, it's all about adolescent drinking. And more younger people are consuming more and more alcohol. What they found is that alcohol, it causes permanent effects because it creates a change in our metabolic profile. That's a new study that they did at the university. And some of these changes were found to correlate to reduced brain gray matter volume, and especially in the young women who are heavy drinkers. And the findings shed new light on the biological implications of adolescence drinking, and that contributes to a lot of less concentration, a lot of inflammation in the brain itself, reducing your gray matter volume. That's not good. That means you're not going to have the same brain power that you would normally have, and you're going to have disruption and snapping of all these dendrites, these wires, they're like wires. They allow a communication from neuron A to neuron B. And if those snap because of a toxin, stress, trauma, injury, or alcohol, then that part of the brain is not easily accessible. And we're finding in younger and younger people. So here's the takeaway message. If you're 25 years old, you've done a lot of drinking, you're not 25 years old biologically, you're closer to 70. And that's why we're seeing people coming down with illnesses and losing much of their memory and ending up with strokes, and especially laying down amyloid plaque that we would normally see in a person in their 70s and 80s with dementia or Alzheimer's, and people in their 30s. Also, the odds of people living to 110 level out once you get to 105. The death rate's slow after 105. And this is the University of California, Berkeley. they took a look at 4,000 extremely old Italians, and they found that if you can survive past 90, if you make it to 105, the death rates slow down, meaning you're going to live longer. And they ask, what is it these people are doing? This was published in the journal Science. And there are certain things that they had in common. And this correlated with my own findings when I went into the one of the trips to Italy. I went into the Italian Alps with two friends who both are Italian and speak fluent Italian. I do not. And we would stop and spend hours in these homes with people, sometimes in the home, sometimes out in the fields. A sense of family and community was big. That's one of the top joys of their life, because they understood that there was no fear of them feeling abandoned or lonely as they got older. To the contrary, the older you get in an Italian culture, by the way, it's also true in many other cultures, in the Spanish culture, and cultures within the Caribbean, you're not abandoned as you get old. In many of American cultures, you do. You're abandoned, and hence depression, loneliness, and all that causes a destruction of your immune system. You actually speed up the death process. But that element of family, the joy you have in knowing you're spending your life with people that care about you and you care about them, the fact that you are not relegated to timetables. It's amazing how few people wore watches or were aware of time. They just had this sense of flowing through a day with ease. Well, it's time to eat, but it took time to prepare the meal. There's no fast foods in these villages. Frequently, those who are responsible for the preparing the food, and the older women, it's their domain. That's their kitchen. They know every herb, every spice, and where out in the fields, it's the men who do the work, and they have their own communication and the respect for each other, and who raises the children, who has the greatest input. All these things are very carefully parsed out. And there is a way of resolving conflict, and they're physically active. You just don't see people sitting all day watching soap operas or on a computer. They're doing things. So what it's showing is that when you live that kind of natural and non-toxic and non-rush, non-stress life, you're going to live a longer life. And they're some of the longest-lived people in the world. And this was presented by the National Institutes of Statistics in Italy. Broccoli could be the next big autism treatment, according to the University of California, San Francisco. So here's the message. Parents of children with autism, remember, autism isn't a disease, it's a spectrum. You can have from mild to extreme. But they're constantly searching for new methods of treatment to help improve their condition, to alleviate the symptoms of the child's condition. And for the most part, the damage has been done when it comes to the effects of the brain, and for that reason, many parents find themselves, well, they're chasing the latest drug. And I've done 5 films on vaccines, but I also had a chance to speak to hundreds of parents for the one film on Vaccine Nation and also on Autism Made in USA. And I spent a couple days out in Chicago at an annual conference where people were following a more natural approach met. And the year I was there filming, there were 400 children who were making improvements. And they had all got together so I could film them. And so all day long, we were going from person to person. And then they all got together in this large conference room, and they were all dressed, and they had from the shortest, littlest, youngest people right up to the teenagers. And it was just one of those sobering movements, because I'm behind the camera and I'm going in on each of their faces and they're smiling. And then at the end, I was ready to say cut and it's a wrap. This one guy steps forward. And I'm guessing he's about 17. And he said, I just want you to know that I have my parents to thank that I'm here. I'm in a regular school now. I no longer am diagnosed as autism on any level because they never gave up on me. Wow. And when you're a director and you're behind a camera, as I am all the time, I'm looking for that ooh-ah moment, that wow moment, that unique moment, and that was it. And I featured that in the film. Because sometimes it's not the most articulate or it's not the most verbose, but rather something that simple, that direct and that hard-hitting. Now think how many times people have stayed with us or given up on us. And especially if they're staying with you because they believe that you deserve a better outcome. Think if we did that as a nation, there wouldn't be any poor people, there wouldn't be any disparity, there wouldn't be any racism, there wouldn't be any wars, there wouldn't be any violence, there wouldn't be any misogyny. Because a part of your empathetic expression would be, honor the other as you would like to be honored. So, that's what I'm seeing when I'm out there. And I was looking at this group, and I was asking, what are you eating? What are you doing? And they were pretty much on what was called the DAN, D-A-N, diet. And I felt that the DAN diet was good, but it was way behind. There was so much more that we could share with them. But a lot of the people out in other groups, autism group, were looking for the drug. And the people supporting their autism support groups are almost always front groups, Astro group, turf groups, that are paid for by Big Pharma. So Big Pharma is controlling the vast majority of what occurs in the world on autism. And it's not helping anybody but themselves and their bottom line. So along comes something as simple as sulforaphane. Sul, S-U-L, furo, F-O-R-A, phane, P-H-A-N-E, sulforaphane. That is the active ingredient in broccoli. And now we can have absolute proof that leads to improvements in social responsiveness and behavior of children with autism spectrum disorder. And there's one study, and it says, quote, identification of urinary metabolites that correlate with clinical improvements in children with autism treated with sulforaphane from broccoli. And this was published in Molecular Autism, and it's a natural, non-toxic approach. Now, it's one good thing. There are a whole lot more that you have to go along with that, like folic acid and methylated, and B12 methylated, and a whole lot of antioxidants that can really help. But this is new, and sulforaphane is derived from broccoli sprouts and broccoli seeds. So Brussels sprouts and cabbage sprouts are also rich in sulforaphane. So when you're eating sauerkraut, you're getting sulforaphane and probiotics. And by the way, every single person I've ever counseled who's had autism as a diagnosis has had problems with their mitochondria in their gut. So rebalancing that gut, cleaning up the gut, the nutrients like glutamine and probiotics are crucial, quercetin, for that gut health. So just make note of that. Cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and broccoli sprouts are all good if you have autism. And from North Carolina State University, stress really can make young adults feel older. That's right. Quote, emerging adults are at an age when they're no longer kids, but they haven't settled into their adulthood yet. We wanted to know if stress affected their subjective age, how old they felt, and we found that it could make a big difference. And so they tracked some people for a long period of time, and they found out that if you're stressed, you're always going to feel older than what you actually are psychologically. Okay, well then de-stress. And finally, from Sapienza University in Italy, there's no difference in the outcomes for children of same-sex versus different-sex parents. That's good news. For children of lesbian or gay parents, psychological adjustment is about the same as in children of heterosexual parents. This was published in the Journal of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics, the official journal of the Society for Development and Behavior Pediatrics. So, good news there. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health nutrition. We're 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a brief break. Come right back. Please stay with us. Guardian, Elizabeth Rush. It's an article entitled Rising Sea. Florida is about to be wiped off the map. Sea level rises are not some distant threat for many Americans. They are very real. In an extract from her chilling new book, Rising, Elizabeth Rush details how the U.S. coastline will radically transform in the coming years. I'll just share a few quotes from this. In 1890, there were about 6,000 people living in the damp lowlands of South Florida. Not anymore. Just in that one area, there's 6 million. And about 60 of the region's more than 6 million residents had gathered for a University of Miami lecture about this. And there was a question asked, and here was the question. Quote, this is the Herald Wanless, chair of the geology department, and about he was going to speak about sea level rise, says, quote, only 7% of heat being trapped by greenhouse gases is stored in the atmosphere. Do you know where the other 93% lives? Well, they didn't. It's in the ocean. That heat is expanding the ocean, which is contributing to sea level rise. And it is also, more importantly, creating the setting for something we really don't want to have happen, rapid melt of ice. So, what's going to happen is that it is inevitable that you're going to see massive melting of Greenland and particularly of Antarctica, because now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, they have found active volcanoes underneath Antarctica, which is melting it from underneath up, and it's shedding 300% more ice than what they had anticipated by any mathematical model. So now you get into what is known as a feedback loop, which means that it can't be stopped. But then there's no way of predicting if it's been changing at 7% every 3 years, well, what will that be in another 20 years? Well, you can't say it'll continue to be 7%. It's going to increase. So we're not looking at 50 years from now or 20 years from now to where the water is rising to where the tide alone at night will come so far inland that all your buildings going from Key West right up the coast of Florida and beyond are going to be structurally unstable. It doesn't mean that you're going to wake up one morning in the 20th floor and walk outside and go for a swim right out the window. It means that when the water comes in at night, it goes down into the soil, a lot of it, not just washed back out with the tide. And every single one of those buildings is being held up based upon concrete pilings that are driven way down into the ground, but they're sitting on sand, not solid rock. So in time, the waves and the movement of the water in the sand will pull all those pilings to a place where they are no longer stable. So you're looking at a massive amount of pain coming to people who are going to have homes that won't be of any value. The communities and state will not have those people's tax base for property because property damage will be so extensive. And it's starting to happen. Just a heads up, because I know there are people in this audience who are listening who live in Miami. And just to add something on to this, because we have a lot of people listening from Europe, the big heat is on the way. As the world warms, so will Europe's drought risk, and its soils will turn increasingly dry. This is from Climate News Network, from Tim Radford. He says, if average global temperature rise by just 3 degrees Celsius, then Europe's drought risk could increase to double the area faced with drying out. That means that whole countries would be affected. That means 400 million people living in Europe could feel the heat as the water content in the European soils begins to evaporate. The worst droughts will last decades. So imagine now, right now, as we speak, there are orchards that are nearly 1,000 years old in Italy that are dead. Spain, dead. Portugal, dead. France, dead. Because they ran out of water. The natural aquifers are gone, and it's too costly to bring water in. Just like in California, the San Joaquin Valley. But unfortunately, people are not looking at the reality of, is this area I'm living in sustainable? And if not, what can I do in a reasonable and responsible, non-rush way to find a better, more sustainable place to live? I suggest people in Europe begin to look. This is just one of those odd things I read. It's Project Debater gets its knowledge from hundreds of millions of journals, but humans still have one key advantage. Well, the human brain may be the ultimate supercomputer, but artificial intelligence, something I've been warning you about, is catching up so fast that it can now hold and even beat any human in anything it does. IBM's Project Debater made its public debut in San Francisco on this past Monday. And it debated the top Israeli debate champion, Noah Ovadia. And then it did one against Dan Zafir, a nationally renowned debater in Israel, and beat them both. So here's where we stand. You can only know so much. You can only process so much information. These new artificial intelligence systems can take everything ever written in the world that's been published. It can take every possible sense of logic into solving problems. In effect, it's thinking with millions of minds to its one. It can immediately scan hundreds of millions of articles to select the articles from which it will develop an answer to any question. So now that we have a artificial intelligence is about to come into the market, it's already there in some forms, imagine what happens to those jobs that people did research no longer needed. How about all the robotics? They're taking the place of all these other people, and this artificial intelligence will be taking the place of a lot of people who are consultants, who are experts. But the computer can think more rationally and without the need to justify biases or political agendas or ideological differences. That's what we're faced with. Set aside the illegal immigrants as an issue, because they're not impacting college-educated people in the current job market. Take aside all the people coming in on these special visas from India and Taiwan and South Korea and China, who have PhDs taking their place at one-third the salary of people who have seniority and been there 25 years and get 2 months vacation. They're all gone. They're going and going and going, and they're going to be gone. So the very people who raise their standard of living to in some form of equal or parity compensation of their income, so if they made $150,000 a year, they generally spent $150,000 a year. But most of what they spent their money on were things that they enjoyed that did not provide value, could not be commercialized. So now you have that class, professional class, who is about to get creamed by artificial intelligence, not robotics, artificial intelligence. And I posted a picture today of an ad of a woman who all you could see is just the woman laying on top of a guy, but now the man is the newest version of a model that can have sex with a woman, and the woman can program her desires, her fantasies, what she likes, doesn't like, into the computer. She can select anything, whatever she wants, she can program in, and then what do you think that's going to do? Well, reverse it. What do you think it would do if the average guy sitting at home, unemployed and, surfing porn all day? What do you think if he could buy a real sex toy, one that looks and feels just like a human being, that does anything you want? What do you think that's going to do with human interactions and human relationships and communication, where the only kind of conversation you're going to have is one that you agree to and that you like? Never criticism, never imperfections. That's with us now, and that's going to increase exponentially. You're going to see a tsunami of sexual robots in the market in the next 2 to 3 years. More attractive, more diversity, more skills, more human-like, until I say within 5 years, if you just looked at one, you couldn't tell that they weren't human. That's being done. Remember, they never tempt you with something unless it's done. They never show you a coming attraction in a movie unless the film is in post-production or done. And now they're waiting to see what kind of response they get. So now we're faced with, what are we going to do with human beings, especially those with college degrees, and especially those in liberal arts, and those that do research? You can get transhumanism, which is the next phase right behind the one that's hitting us now, robotics and artificial intelligence. It's robotics now, artificial intelligence, transhumanism, and they're all in play now. Four companies in Silicon Valley, like Google and Facebook, those companies, four of them, have a value of $4 trillion. And there's not parity, there's disparity, the influence they have. Something to think about. So understand what you're going to need for the future. And by the way, from Natural Blaze, over 10 million American seniors currently facing food insecurity. Quote, despite the government and its media mouthpieces constant claims regarding the end of the Great Recession and the elusive recovery, America is still experiencing depression and unemployment rates and vastly lower standards of living. And while the U.S. government touts unemployment rates of 3%, the reality is that it's over 20% range. I say it's 27%. I've done the statistics on it. And by the way, every time you hear them say that we are so prosperous and there's so much money being made, absolutely there are companies making money and there are people within those companies making money and their shareholders making money, but against how much debt? And there's trillions of dollars in corporate debt, state debt, local community debt, personal debt, credit card debt, car payment debt, student loan debt, mortgage debt. And when you add all those up, plus entitlements, unfunded entitlements, including Medicare, you're at $200 trillion. That means at the very minimum, we are 1,200% debt to gross domestic product. We are the most bankrupt country of all the countries in the world. There's no way in the world we're going to pay back our debt. we can't even pay the interest on the debt without cutting other programs. We never cut the programs that need to be cut, like military-industrial complex. We cut social services, including things that could help these 10 million American seniors currently living each day without adequate food. Just something to think about, because you're not going to hear that in the mainstream media. Now, we're going to play a little segment here. I thought you'd like to hear from the really smart people, the humanistic people, the spiritual people, the experts. They bring in a Fox to tell us the truth about these detention camps. And so now we're going to hear from an expert on these detention camps.
Say this, you know, people aren't stupid. I spoke to some African Americans who say, gosh, the conditions of the detention center are better than some of the projects that I grew up in.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. May God have mercy on your soul.
Yeah, I can high-five that. I could say that about most of the hosts over there and the laptops for Trunk. Now, here's something I thought was interesting. This is Naomi Wolf, who is pro-Israel. She is certainly pro-Judaism and speaks fluent Hebrew. But she said, why I would not return to Israel. Short 3 minutes. Please listen.
Go back to Israel if you had the chance to? And if yes, what would be the reason? And if no, what would be the reason? Do you have, like, motives?
Would I go back to Israel?
Yeah.
And what was the last thing you said?
Would you go back to Israel if you had the chance to? Like, to live there?
Oh, to live? I don't think I could ever live in Israel again unless there was a huge awakening along these lines. How can I live in a society that's just declared that some people are more equal than other people? It's like if you were to ask me, could you live in a Christian America where Congress declared that America's a Christian nation and everyone else doesn't count as much? I would want to get my kids out of that country as quickly as possible. I would go back to report on it if I felt I could do so safely, because obviously I have a responsibility to be there if I'm going to be talking about it, to report on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's more as a Jew, you're more usually you should feel it's your homeland, promised land. So usually they're like more triggered to go there because they have this sense of belonging. Because I'm Muslim,
yes.
And one of my best friends is Jews, and she goes back and forth. Although we have like some trouble discussing the topics,
yeah.
There is also. I understand her position, her way of thinking, like wanting to go back there, but I just want to see your position.
Right. Thank you for clarifying where your question is coming from. I should explain then that I know what she's talking about, and absolutely, well, first when you're there, you know, being a religious minority, it is incredibly affirming to see the policeman's Jewish, the lunch lady's Jewish. It's incredibly validating if you're used to being the other or the hated other, right? But if I don't see, I guess I've crossed a divide where, you know, I've heard so many Palestinians tell that exact same story of longing just to go home. And I guess I sort of feel about Israel and that longing to go home, which I feel, right? I feel at home there. I speak Hebrew. I have that sense of belonging historically, but it's like gay marriage and straight marriage. Does anyone deserve to be married if some people can't be married? Do I get to go home if other people who have the keys to their property can't go home, you know? Why can't we all go home, right? I mean, I didn't know until I made friends with human rights lawyers in Jordan that the law of return, I thought it was some crazy terrorist thing made up by crazy extremists. The law of return is international law that says that refugees get to go home. You know, and if I know what it's like to go to Berlin with my children's father and have him see the apartment that his family was kicked out of in the 30s, and I know how validating it is for reparations from Germany to acknowledge the loss and the theft and the expulsion of my people, how can I not want people who've been kicked out just like we have to be able at least to have their history acknowledged, at least to talk about reparations, at least to do everything possible to make it a home for people who deserve by law to be there. I would feel more at home then, right?
And that was Naomi Wolf and why she would not go back to Israel until things change. Everyone had that same perspective. Now, I'm going to share a few thoughts, and then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to go to our guest, who will be standing by in about 7 minutes. And we're going to talk with Marjorie Cohen about, will Congress authorize indefinite detention of Americans who oppose the executive policies? We're becoming a nation of censorship. We're becoming a nation of fake facts and people using their power and positions within governmental agencies as well as major corporations and the media to say, we will hear your voice, but we will not hear these other voices. These other voices are quackery or nonsense or dangerous, and therefore we're excluding them from all platforms and legitimacy. We're going to talk to her about that. But we're going to take just a very short break, and then we'll come back, and then in about 4 minutes we'll go to Marjorie Cohen. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest in about 4 minutes, but I have some good news for those of you who've been waiting for over 6 months for the return of Supremacy Strawberry. It is now, as of this morning, it is back in stock and it's on sale. This has been my most popular vitamin C. You're getting 625 milligrams of the best vitamin C I could possibly produce. You're getting it with ascorbic acid and strawberry and beets and acerola complex, and magnesium ascorbate, selenium and manganese ascorbate, potassium ascorbate, zinc ascorbate, and a natural fruit sweetener. So this is the most popular. I'm sorry we've been out of it. It took a long time to get it because there was a shortage of vitamin C, and I do very small batches, like 1,000 bottles. Other companies do 1 million bottles or 100,000 bottles. They don't run out. And I want fresher product. I want product that's always fresh. And they might have theirs for 5 years. I don't. In any case, it's back today. Supremacy Strawberry back in stock. And earlier this week, we also got our green stuff back in stock. So green stuff is back. Supremacy, and it's on special. And you can call and our salespeople are standing by. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Strawberry Supremacy back in stock after 6 months, a half year not having it. We now have it. 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Persuaded me to love you, and I did, but instead of tending, I found home. love away from me.
Okay, we're going out to San Diego, California. We're standing by is Marjorie Cohen, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, a criminal defense attorney, and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. And she specialized in international human rights, crimes such as torture and drone strikes, and U.S. foreign policy. And she is currently the Deputy Secretary General of the Bureau of International Association of Democratic Lawyers. And she, having served as a legal observer in Iran, Marjorie has received many awards, including the Peace Scholar of the Year Award and Amnesty International's Human Rights Defender Award. And she is the author. Her writings have appeared in the Fordham Law Review, the Hastings Law Journal, the National Law Journal, as well as Truth Dig and Common Dreams, Counterpunch. And her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues, which includes a foreword by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and her website with articles and analysis is MarjorieCohen.com. Nice to have you with us today, Marjorie.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
Marjorie, I want to go back briefly to Trump's inauguration when the police trapped and arrested over 230 people in anti-Trump demonstrations. Now, federal prosecutors then charged them with felony rioting, which is actually a non-existent crime in Washington, D.C. And afterwards, the prosecution conducted a sweeping investigation into the defendants' lives, demanding vast amounts of online information through secret warrants. And although some of the defendants' cases were dropped, such as those of journalists and legal observers, the charges increased for everyone else, charging over 200 with the felony of inciting a riot, conspiracy, and facing up to 60 years in prison. And since taking office, Trump has shown he has no tolerance for dissension or free speech that challenges his authority. The boy king would even imprison media opposition if he could. And his white identity politics even targets African-American descent, which has a long and even distinguished history in America. So now we have a bill pending in Congress, S. Resolution 59, that would give Trump even more executive power to use military force on domestic issues such as public dissent, and as you have noted in a recent article, a blank check to detain American citizens indefinitely without any criminal charge. And sadly, a Democratic Senator, Tim Kaine, co-sponsored the bill. And the bill would... Is this the same Tim Kaine that was Hillary Clinton's running mate, by the way, for vice president? And the bill would also permit the president to launch wars wherever he chooses without limitation instead of getting the approval of Congress. So please take your time and share with us the most salient details in this expansion of Bush's earlier authorization for use of military force bill and the language that rules that people who dissent or protest against Trump's military policies could be detained in prison indefinitely. The form is yours.
Thank you, Gary. Yes, this bill was introduced by Bob Corker, Republican, Tim Kaine, Democrat, as you said. It has four co-sponsors. There's another bill that I'll mention as well that was introduced a month ago. The first bill was introduced mid-April. The second bill was introduced the end of May by Jeff Merkley. It doesn't have any co-sponsors, and it would be it would constrain the president more than this Kaine-Corker bill. And it's not clear whether either of these bills is going to get enough votes to pass, because Trump doesn't. They would basically have to get two-thirds of the Senate to override a veto, because Trump doesn't want any constraints on his power. But in terms of the Corker-Kaine bill, which is SJ Res 59, as you said, it would allow the president to use all necessary and appropriate force against Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Taliban, and their associated forces. And that's the key. Associated forces could even be a person, could be an organization, a person, or a force that has entered the fight alongside and is a co-belligerent with one of these groups. Now, the bill doesn't contain any definition of co-belligerent, so the president could conceivably claim that a U.S. citizen who writes, speaks out, or demonstrates against U.S. military action is a co-belligerent and lock him or her up indefinitely without charge. In other words, it would allow the president to declare war on a person. The Merkley bill does not allow the president to use force against associated forces. So it would be harder to detain indefinitely an American citizen under the Merkley bill. But keep in mind that in 2001, Congress gave George W. Bush an authorization for the use of military force. That's called an AUMF. These would replace that AUMF. And that AUMF only authorized the president to use all necessary and appropriate force against individuals and groups responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Nevertheless, three presidents, Bush, Obama, and Trump, have used that 2001 AUMF to justify at least 37 military operations in 14 countries, many of them unrelated to 9/11. So the presidents are going to do what they want. Now, the Merkley bill requires that Congress approve any use of military force. The Corker-Kane bill basically allows the president to do what he wants as long as he comes to Congress and reports to Congress, and Congress will doesn't have to do anything. They can just let him continue to use force, or they can put the brakes on. There is another real distinction between these two pending bills that I think is significant, and that is that there is a transparency requirement in the Merkley bill. So the president has to outline the objectives of the war on the terrorist groups and strategies. He has to report on the civilian casualties and combat casualties. And if there's any disparity between the numbers that he's reporting and the numbers of leading non-governmental organizations, he's got to explain that disparity. Also, the Merkley bill would require the president to comply with international law, and that is the proportional use of force, proportionality, not disproportionate to the military advantage sought, and distinguishing between combatants and civilians. Those are both those are both part of international humanitarian law. The Kane-Corker bill doesn't have any sunset. After 4 years, the president reports to Congress, and Congress can do nothing and let him continue with it if they want. But the Merkley bill does have a 3-year sunset provision. So the Merkley bill is better than the Kane-Corker bill, but I don't think that it's going to get much support because in a month it hasn't been able to garner even one co-sponsor. I'm not even convinced that Congress would go for the Kane-Corker bill, because both Democrats and Republicans alike have basically given a blank check to the president when it comes to using military force. They've put no limits at all to speak of on the invasions, the illegal bombings of Syria that Trump carried out ostensibly in retaliation against the use of chemical weapons. It was an illegal bombing under the UN Charter, two illegal bombings. He's been using drones to kill people, many of them civilians in other countries. They didn't put the brake on Obama, who used drones in 7 different countries, or on George W. Bush, who was responsible for the killing of hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, both illegal wars under the UN Charter, and I've written about this extensively. So there are other statutes that could allow for the indefinite detention of individuals, particularly U.S. citizens. There is the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, and Obama, when he signed it, he attached a signing statement saying that it did not limit or expand the authority of the president or the scope of the AUMF, but he pledged that my administration will not authorize the indefinite military detention without trial of American citizens. So Obama's statement implied that while a president does have the power to indefinitely detain Americans, he chose not to exercise that power. Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, the senator, said that National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 would, quote, basically say in law for the first time that the homeland is part of the battlefield and people could be held without charge by the military, American citizen or not. Now, a group of human rights activists and journalists, including Noam Chomsky, Dan Ellsberg, Chris Hedges, sued the U.S. government. They claim that this 2012 National Defense Authorization Act would have a chilling effect on their freedom of speech because they could be arrested if the president didn't like what they were saying or they were being critical of his policies. And although a lower federal district court judge found that part to be unconstitutional, agreeing with these journalists and human rights activists, the Court of Appeals disagreed and said, well, this National Defense Authorization Act has no bearing on the government's authority to detain American citizen plaintiffs because it says nothing about the government's authority to detain citizens. So in other words, it doesn't spell it out in black and white, and therefore nothing to worry about. So that's basically the two bills that are pending. There have been prior attempts, including one by Obama himself, to replace or streamline the 2001 AUMF that Congress gave Bush, and there's also a 2002 AUMF that Congress gave Bush to basically get Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction out of Iraq. Now, once that was accomplished, then that license ended, although that AUMF has been used to justify going after ISIS in Iraq. But both of these two pending bills would repeal these two prior 2001 and 2002 AUMFs. But when there have been attempts in the past, either in Congress or, as I said, by Obama, to streamline and get authorization basically for the use of force against ISIS, which is not included, it's not covered by either of those two prior AUMFs, Congress has shown little appetite for that. Neither Mitch McConnell nor Paul Ryan seem to be interested in constraining Trump's power in any way in terms of military power. The other thing that the Merkley bill would do basically is to say no ground troops. And, you know, that's a political hot button. I mean, when one thing that the U.S. government learned in Vietnam was that Americans don't like to see Americans coming back in body bags, flag-draped coffins. And so that's why the U.S. has gone to bombing, the use of drones, special forces. So the ground troops is always, you know, it's kind of a hot button political issue. It's not really clear that Congress is going to take up either of these bills, and I think you're right. I think there's a real danger that Trump could indefinitely lock up Americans. Now, there have been some Supreme Court cases on the detention of Americans. One was the Hamdi case. Hamdi was a U.S. citizen. He was caught in Afghanistan. Hamdi versus Rumsfeld was a 2004 case from the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court basically upheld his enemy combatant designation, but limited its holding to people fighting against U.S. forces in Afghanistan. It did not include the broader so-called war on terrorism. The Supreme Court in Hamdi also said U.S. citizens held as enemy combatants must be provided due process to contest the factual basis for their detention before a neutral decision maker. But the Supreme Court has not ruled on whether a U.S. citizen who's apprehended in the United States can be detained indefinitely. It punted on the case of Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen arrested in Chicago, held in military custody as an enemy combatant by the Bush administration, relying on the 2001 AUMF. Basically, the court said that Padilla's habeas corpus petition was filed in the wrong place. Eventually, he was charged with crimes. He was convicted, notwithstanding his isolation for more than 3 years in torture while in custody. But two of the U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeals came to opposite conclusions about whether an American citizen who is apprehended on U.S. soil could be held indefinitely as an enemy combatant. There's another American citizen currently being detained by the U.S. government in Iraq since September of 2017. His name is John Doe. What they call him. He's a U.S.-Saudi citizen. He has dual citizenship. He was named an enemy combatant for allegedly fighting for ISIS, and the Defense Department in April tried to transfer him to Saudi Arabia to avoid an adverse judicial ruling in the case, but a federal judge blocked the move. The case is Doe versus Mattis. So it's up in the air. The Supreme Court has not decided whether a U.S. citizen who is arrested on U.S. soil can be held indefinitely. But the way the Supreme Court is headed, all bets are off. It's quite frightening.
Thank you very much for coming on and giving us this update. We really appreciate it. I look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Professor Marjorie Cohen, and she's the author of Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal Moral and Geopolitical Issues. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.